supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. We all know about modern medicine. It's fast-paced, brief visit to the doctors, focusing on symptom control. In general, modern medicine views the body as a machine, illness as a breakdown, and the doctor essentially is a mechanic. But pre-modern medicine took a different view of the body and of illness. It saw the body more like a garden, with the physician healer cultivating the body's natural health. Well, now there's a new trend called slow medicine, and it harkens back to some of these pre-modern principles. Here to tell us more about it is Dr. Victoria Sweet. She teaches medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. She's an award-winning historian. Her highly acclaimed book, God's Hospital, A Doctor, A Hospital, and A Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, has just been released in paperback. It's the story of her many years spent at an almshouse in San Francisco where she practiced slow medicine. Victoria, it's great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. So, Victoria, like I said, you learned about slow medicine at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, but I'd like to get started a little bit earlier than that. I want to know the physician who came to that hospital. I was particularly touched when you described your first autopsy when you became a physician, and it wasn't on a cadaver.
Yes, that's right. That's how the book begins. And it was long before, of course, I became a physician. It was in my first, it was the first autopsy I ever did in the pathology clerkship that you would have. So you have in medical school, you do your pathology on specimens that you, corpses of bodies that you've that you've never met. But this autopsy turned out to be on my patient, Mr. Baker, who was my first patient I'd ever had in the hospital. And he'd been just a wonderful guy. He'd had emphysema from cigarette smoking, and that's why I had had him. And he'd been just a lovely guy, and I thought he'd done really well and been discharged. And then there I was at my first autopsy, and the covers are thrown back, and there is Mr. Baker. But the thing was, is when I looked at him, it sort of looked like Mr. Baker, but the more I looked at him, the less it looked like Mr. Baker, but more like a figure in a wax museum. And as I watched the autopsy going on, I was stunned really more by the difference between Mr. Baker's body and the Mr. Baker I'd known. It was the very beginning of my career as a doctor, so I just kind of tucked away what I'd seen there of this idea that the person was really, that the body was just a forgotten element in tucked away someplace in the corner of a room, which is what I got when I watched him get his autopsy. This sense of the difference between the living person and the dead body was really very profound. And I tucked it away, and I didn't take that image out till much later after I'd become been a doctor for quite a few years. And I began to see other things in patients that I hadn't expected from what I'd learned in medical school and what I did in my residency, the sense that there's so much more going on in a person between doctor and patient than we learn about in medical school, which is a bit of a cliche, but when you actually see it, it doesn't feel like a cliche.
You talked about something missing in hindsight. What was missing for you?
Well, at the time, I didn't know what it was, but later when I studied pre-modern medicine in my PhD, I learned that there used to be a name for this, several names, as a matter of fact. It was called anima, which is gives us the word animation, right? Anima was sometimes translated as soul, but really it's that force that moves the body, that causes all the heart to beat, all the stuff that causes the body to move was called in pre-modern era the anima, which we translate as soul, but it's not a very good translation.
I was struck by, that was my first underline in your book, spiritus.
Well, the spiritus was the second word that was used, and spiritus is a really interesting word. It's Latin. That's what we get the word spirits from, as in spirits to drink and good spirits. But it originally meant the breath, and the breath that goes in and out of the body, and that connection between what we think of today as the spirit of the person and the breath were linked traditionally in many different cultures, not just in Latin, but in Greek, in Hebrew, and in Chinese.
Well, you know, in Hebrew, the word is ruach, and it means soul. It means wind, and it means breath.
Well, I think when you see, some of your listeners may have seen, when you see anything dead, the difference, whether it's a dead person or a dead bird or a dead dog, the difference between the being that you knew and that dead thing is really profound.
Yeah, I remember I saw my mother hours after she died, and you know, she was there, and I held her hand.
Oh, wow.
And I just stared at her abdomen. I couldn't believe it wasn't moving. I mean, it was shocking to me that there she was and it wasn't moving. It's almost exactly your reaction.
That's right. That's right. It's almost like you're stunned because just seems so clear that they are, in fact, gone. You know, in those old movies, they'd come out and they'd say, well, you know, Alex is gone, right? And it seemed like it was just a way to not say what was really going on. But when you actually see it, that's exactly what it feels like. Like they're gone someplace, and you can't find them anymore.
I want to get to slow medicine with you, but first tell us about the hospital, its history, and the patients who were there when you arrived. Because your description sounded like it would be a great movie.
Well, a lot of us have thought of that who practiced in it. Well, I got there kind of accidentally because after I'd gotten out and become an internist and started practicing and then really began thinking a lot about these concepts, I decided I was going to go back and get a PhD in medical history to understand what had been left out of the modern medicine I'd been taught. And it turned out at the time the only place that would let me practice medicine part-time was this unusual hospital, Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, which was unusual both in how it looked and how it functioned. So when I drove over there for the first time, I'd never seen it before. It looked like a medieval monastery. So it had long open wards that were called the Nightingale Wards. It had almost 1,200 patients. It was on 62 acres of land in the middle of the city. And when I did a little research, I gradually learned that it had originally been the San Francisco almshouse. And the almshouse was how we used to take care of patients before there was health insurance. So the way it worked was that every county had an almshouse and every county had an acute hospital, and anybody could go. And they were funky and they weren't equal, but they were adequate. And in the 50s, almost every county in the country lost their almshouse. They were closed for reasons of justice from the left and economy from the right, except in San Francisco. So Laguna Honda had originally been the San Francisco almshouse and had last been built in the 20s. So it looked like a medieval monastery. It was huge, and it had these long open wards where patients would be taken care of, which I'm sure some of your listeners have seen in the old movies. It also had a church with stained glass windows and wooden pews and the Stations of the Cross. It had many, many, many gardens.
How did it survive in this economy, I would think there'd be tremendous pressure to cut that down to sell that off.
Well, you would be absolutely right. For a long time, the first 10 years I was there, it was literally over the hill to the poorhouse, literally. And nobody paid it any mind, which was fantastic for the practice of medicine and nursing because we could just do what the patient needed and people left us alone. But then it was discovered, and people on the left were really upset that patients had no privacy and they're in these open wards, and people had a right to privacy and a right to be taken care of in their own homes. So they began a big push to close it. And, of course, the right was more than happy to do that. But there was a big pushback by the citizens of San Francisco. It was simply the citizens of San Francisco refused to let Laguna Honda go.
That sounds like San Francisco. Tell us about the patients who were there, Victoria.
They were incredible. Incredible patients. I mean, that's why I stayed. I came to be there for 2 months, and I ended up staying for more than 20 years because of the patients. So, well, the thing about an almshouse in general, and Laguna Honda in specific, is that it gets the sort of 0.1% of people who fall through the cracks. And so it ends up actually with all the patients were 2 standard deviations from the mean. So they were the tallest and the shortest and the fattest and the thinnest patients I'd ever had. They were the most interesting patients. They had interesting lives, and they had really unusual diseases, and they were tough. So they were really a pleasure to take care of in their own way because of all those different things. So I saw basically everything in my medical textbook, because if something was 1 in 100,000, well, we'd get a couple of cases at Laguna Honda, since it was a catchment area for San Francisco, which had like 700,000. Population. So I saw a little bit of everything, and so they were very challenging medically, but because I had enough time, since we were over there at the poorhouse and nobody paid us any mind, I could do what I thought was right for the patients, which mostly was listening to them, doing a thorough physical exam, trying to figure out what was really wrong with them, and then taking off as many medications as I could. All right. Because most of them had collected tons of medications that they didn't need.
All right, so let me stop you there. This this is the beginning of what sounds like slow medicine, and let me reintroduce you, because I want to hear more about that, what that is. This is Dr. Victoria Sweet you've been listening to. She's an associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of California and a prize-winning medical historian. She's teaching us about slow medicine, which integrates a lot of pre-modern medical techniques. And we're going to hear more about it. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you. So, Victoria, tell us about this whole business of taking patients off medication.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite things, actually.
Do you have any appointments open in the next couple of days?
Yeah, really. Well, what I was struck by because I had enough time, and we all had enough time to just put some thought and sometimes not do a whole lot of anything, is on average, most of the patients that we got were on between about 15 and 26 medications. And I would find that most of them needed 3 or 4 of those medicines, but they didn't need the other 10 or 12 or 15 or 20. And as I gradually took them off those medications, as you can imagine, a lot of times they got a lot better. And that's where I started seeing that the patients got better. The system was saved, of course, a lot of money, because every medication you give a patient costs $5 to $10 a day if you add in all the care that goes into giving the medication, side effects, adverse reactions, etc. And that's when I started thinking about what I was doing at Laguna Honda as slow medicine, as opposed to the fast medicine. And, of course, I also practice, right? If somebody has an appendicitis, I don't do slow medicine on them. I have them have an appendectomy. But many of the patients needed something slower, in the sense of slowly taking them off medications, checking and see how they did, if they had a problem, seeing if it went away on its own, if it wasn't serious. And because I had time to do that, wasn't rushed, I found I could take people off many, many of their medications.
Time. You've used that word a couple of times, Dr. Sweet. ain't much of that going around, that time thing.
Yeah, I know.
You know, 14 minutes mm-hmm. with your doctor.
Yeah, I know.
So how do you find it? Nobody else seems to be able to.
Well, I'm not finding it now, but, I mean, at the way Laguna Honda, the old Laguna Honda worked was, it evolved in that way, and nobody had sort of stopped that evolution. But what's happened today, I think, has been in the interest of efficiency and controlling healthcare costs, I believe that healthcare economists have made a bit of a understandable error. And they thought these last 30 years that doctors were very expensive. And so they've done all kinds of things to literally have you spend the least amount of time with your doc. And of course, now that we have the computer and the internet, even less. But I don't think that's the case. I mean, a doctor like me at Laguna Honda, and if I spent an hour with a patient, it was like cost maybe $100, maybe $150. And if during that time I can take patients off tons of medication or I can determine that they don't need an MRI, I've actually saved the system thousands of dollars. But what's happened, and so I call actually what we did at Laguna Honda, I call that the efficiency of inefficiency. Right, because every economist would look at what we did at Laguna Honda and go, oh, that's really inefficient, a doctor spending an hour with the patient. But primary care docs are just not that expensive. And so there have been all of these, not all, but many, many things that have happened in the last 20 years to try deliberately and decrease the amount of time you spend with your doctors and nurses in the interest of efficiency.
Well, and we see
more and more inefficient.
Right, and we see where healthcare costs are going, and we're seeing the efficacy or lack thereof of our system. Your thinking was based on, in part, on mm-hmm. on the writings of Hildegard van Bingen. She's a 12th century Benedictine nun and a medical practitioner. Was she the one that talked about the body as a garden?
Well, that was very interesting. She actually, the clue I had to this whole concept was from her, and it was from her use of the word viriditas. She wrote in Latin, which is from viridis, which means green in Latin, and it means greening or greening power. And it's a concept in all of Hildegard's work. She talks about the greening power of human beings, and that is what you nurture and cultivate when you take care of a patient.
Are we talking about almost a life force here?
Well, there you go. I looked at that for a long time. I thought originally that's what she meant, and I think it is in part what she meant. But it actually led me on a long voyage, pulling this string all the way back to understanding that what really was going on is that, and it's natural. So today we think people as computers or machines, partly because we're surrounded by computers and machines. That's our environment. And when we try and understand what's inside the invisible body, we use what's around us. So in Hildegard's time, and even before her, what everybody did was garden and farm. That was what they saw around them. They saw the natural world. They saw its changes with the seasons. They saw its greening, its ripening, its dying, its production. They knew how to take care of plants. And what they did is they took that understanding, and that's how they understood the body. So that I think it's in part life force, but there's something more to it, actually, than that. There's a sense of individuality. So Hildegard would talk about the viriditas of certain plants, and it actually originally meant green sap. And this idea so that what's going on with a plant, right? Its life force is its sap, but it's also something physical. So Hildegard turns out she meant an abstraction, life force, but just the way spiritus is an abstraction, spirit, but it's also something real, breath, so that viriditas was life force, but it's also something real. So it was this stuff in the body that circulated. And I never could decide how physical she meant it. In some ways, it almost looked like what we mean by hormone, that it was a physical substance in the blood that circulated that you were actually nurturing.
Well, I want to tell you a story about an experience I had with that. You got a minute?
I got your minute, yeah.
Okay. So many years ago, when I wrote about this in one of my books, many years ago, I had a decubitus ulcer. And for the listeners, it's kind of a bed sore.
Wow.
That we people who sit in wheelchairs, I mean, that's the bane of our existence. We So I went to my doctor, and it was 3 centimeters. And he looked at it, and he said, you've got to go to bed for about 30 days. And I said, 30 days? Mm-hmm. Why? So he said, wounds to the skin heal at a rate of 1 millimeter a day if the environment's healthy.
And lovely. Wow, you had a great doctor.
Oh, my God.
That's trippy.
And, you know, as a psychologist, I thought, what about wounds to the soul? Wounds to the mind or the heart? And then he covered it, you know, he cleaned it, and then he covered it over with a brown patch that I don't think they use anymore called Duoderm. And I said, wait a minute. I said, I thought my wound needed oxygen to heal. Why are you covering it? And he said, the oxygen your wound needs to heal is in the blood, not in the air. He said, everything your wound needs to heal is in your body.
God, he was fantastic.
Yeah, he was, and he still is. But that's exactly what Hildegard was assuming, and modern medicine has proved her right, you know? And
lovely.
Well, I guess that's no surprise to you.
That's a wonderful story, though, actually. Beautiful.
We've got to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk some more about slow medicine and how it works and how it can work in today's world. We're talking with Dr. Victoria Sweet. She talks about slow medicine. She's the author of God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. Later on in the show, we're going to be talking with Dennis McCullough. He's been a geriatrician for 30 years, and he also practices slow medicine with his geriatric population. Our number, if you want to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
1 in 3 families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child aged 12 to 25 that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at IamConcerned.org.
The Richard A. Reif Heart Institute of Doylestown Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack strikes, cardiac specialists know it's survival of the fastest. At Doylestown, they've worked to streamline every step of the treatment process, striving for faster care, fewer complications, and the best possible outcomes. Located on West State Street in Doylestown, the Heart Institute is now easily accessible via the Route 202 expansion. Details at dh.org/heart.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Dr. Victoria Sweet. Among other things, she is a prize-winning medical historian, and we're talking about slow medicine. We touched on it in the first segment of our show, and I'd love to hear from you at 888-477-9499. If you have experienced this, slow medicine, touch, time, compassion, caring, and someone who kind of views your body as something that's basically healthy and the health that needs to be nurtured, we'd love to hear from you. So, Victoria, tell me about what it looks like. Give us a clinical example of what slow medicine looks like.
I'm thinking of between two of them. I think where this all gelled for me was actually with a patient that looked, when I first admitted her, like she would be the sort of classic patient for a chronic care facility. She was 70 8 years old at the time I admitted her, and from the sound of it, when I first got her, it looked like she was demented. She'd fallen and broken a hip. She had diabetes. She couldn't manage her daughter, who was developmentally delayed, and she was on about 26 medications, and it looked pretty bad. It looked like she was going to have to be here forever from the sound of it on the on paper and from the report I got. But when I went and saw her, she wasn't. She was a lot more lively than it looked like on paper. There was something about her. And supposedly she couldn't walk as part of her dementia, but when I examined her, it was clear that what was actually going on is that when she'd fallen and broke her hip and they'd replaced it, it had gotten dislocated. And so that all the rehab she'd been having, the failed rehab, was not failing because of her dementia, but was failing because the hip had been dislocated and nobody had had the wherewithal to realize that. But because Laguna Honda was so funky, we had our own x-ray machine, so I sent her upstairs and x-rayed it and looked at it and dislocated and called her surgeon, and she went over and got the hip put back in place. And when she came back, because she was feeling a bit better and didn't have so much pain, I could start taking her off the pain medication she'd collected over those 6 months since her hip surgery. And as I took her off her pain medicine, she got brighter, and it began clear that she wasn't really demented. She'd just been snowed by all the pain medication, so I took her off her antipsychotic medication slowly. And then I gradually realized that she didn't even have diabetes either, that that had been kind of an overdiagnosis, so I took her off her small amounts of insulin. And after about 3 months, she wanted to try walking again. We sent her to therapy, and she began walking, and she eventually got discharged after about 5 months on essentially no medications. She went back to live in her own house, and there she lived for the next 4 or 5 years until she did pass away. But it was that case that made me really think about what I was able to do at a funky, old-fashioned place like Laguna Honda that you couldn't do anyplace else, because I added it all up. Because this was all in the context of getting emails all the time from the administrator and the head of the hospital, you know, watch, you know, try and be efficient and don't order tests that don't need to be ordered, stuff like that. When I added it all up, I figured out that whatever I was doing at Laguna Honda had saved the system hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that's when I came up with the idea of calling up, thinking about it as slow medicine, because I thought this is like, it's the opposite of fast medicine in the same way that there's fast food and there's slow food. And that was the patient as I watched her walk out of the hospital and get in a taxi and be driven home. That's the patient that made me really think about what slow medicine could be, even in the context of our healthcare efficiency system.
I've got to tell you, you know, I listened to your story just now and the vision of her getting in the cab, and what I feel, my emotion when you told me that story was sadness, because of the context of today's medicine. I mean, can that be done? You're no longer at you know, that hospital, and you know, now I'll bet you're looking like a regular doctor now. You know, can you do that, or is your office funky?
Well, there's good news.
Please.
There's the good news. So first of all, let me say I'm not practicing medicine at the moment. I had thought I would be practicing medicine, but the book has just been like a wave on top of me. It's been fantastic, but my goal with the book was partly to capture what I learned at Laguna Honda so that other people could see it before it no longer existed at all. But it was also to get people thinking about what we could do instead. And in the meantime, so right now I'm actually waiting for something. I'm not going to practice medicine unless I can practice medicine the way I think it should be practiced. In the meantime, however, this whole model of so-called concierge medicine, which is a terrible name, some people are trying to call it retainer medicine, but where docs, other docs, and nurses for that matter, are realizing all of this, and there's a group of docs individually across the country who've sort of stepped out of the system and said, I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take care of the patients that I can manage, and I'm going to be a real doc. And in order to do that, I'll take a model out of the legal system and charge a retainer fee. of it's usually about $150 to $200 a month. Now, that's quite a bit of money, as many people have pointed out. But the thing is, what they're doing for us is they're actually doing an experiment. An experiment, and my hypothesis is that money will be well spent. That they will easily, that a doc who takes care of patients that way will actually save way more than the $2,400 a year it costs.
Well, you're talking about what it will save for the system. I mean, what troubles me is most people can't afford that.
Yes, but if you were an insurance company and you saw that and you said, wow, we could pay $2,400 per patient, $200 a month, and we could save... We could save well more than that. Why wouldn't the insurance companies do that? That's the experiment, that because it's the efficiency piece that we need to grapple with. I don't think that where we're headed is efficient. I think it's inefficient, and we're just getting more and more inefficient. What I mean by inefficient is we're spending more and more money for less and less actual medical care. So, but in order to do that, we can't. I don't think we can build from the system as it is. We need to build an alternative way to do things. And so these docs are doing that, and they're performing an experiment for us. And that experiment is, let's see if this is more cost-efficient. Because I do trust capitalism, that if it's more cost-efficient, then the insurance companies will do it. So that's one piece. And then the second piece is actually doing this myself with what I've called the Ecomedicine Project, which is actually taking a group, getting a piece of a hospital. It's literally practicing medicine this way, and just taking care, seeing what our costs are like, and meet the healthcare efficiency issue head face to face and head to head, and say this way of practicing isn't just better for the patient and the doctor; it's actually cheaper.
Cheaper. You've already proven in just 40 minutes of being on the air that you are some kind of medical heretic. So speaking of some of your bizarre ideas.
Yes.
You believe that the doctor-patient relationship should include love?
Well, I hate that L word. It's so overused. You know, we love ice cream and we love our phone and we love all those things from advertisement. But I do... So, I only won't even say love, honestly. I mean, I do think it is actually love. But I think it's even more attention. You know, I mean, even if you hate somebody, you're attending to them. You're there with them in their reality. And as a psychologist, you know how healing that is. So love is, I do end the book that way, and I think it's true, but I think there's a way of attending, of being with the patient that's healing. And the thing is, it's healing not only for the patient, it's healing for the doctor, too.
I approach my patients with a curious mind and an open heart, and it is of my firm belief that if we can bear witness to someone, if we can find compassion and experience their emotions and not try to jump in and intervene but just resonate, to me, that's an act of love. Just doing that, and that's what you're describing.
Yes, it is. It's exactly right.
Yeah. Let's take a break because I want to bring in Dennis McCullough because he's got a slightly an additional dimension to bring to this discussion. We've been talking with Dr. Victoria Sweet. The book she was referring to is God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. And like she said, it's just come out in paperback. It's an incredible book. We'd love to hear from you, by the way. 888-477-9499. When we come back, we're going to hear from Dennis McCullough. He's been a geriatrician for 30 years. He serves as a faculty member in the Department of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School, and his book is called My Mother, Your Mother. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Penn Program for Mindfulness will sponsor two mindfulness meditation events on May 10th and 11th, exploring mindfulness and meditation as powerful tools for personal growth and transformation. Events will include a Friday evening lecture by Sharon Salzberg about mindfulness meditation and a half-day workshop on meditation as a tool for compassion. For information on all programs offered, online at pennmedicine.org/mindfulness or 215-615-2775.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. Since 1918, the Philadelphia Foundation has built healthy communities. It supports nonprofit organizations that strengthen neighborhoods, broaden access to services, promote health, and sustain basic human needs. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such southeastern Pennsylvania nonprofits today and forever, while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Doctors Victoria Sweet and Dennis McCullough about slow medicine. As I said before the break, Dennis McCullough is a geriatrician for over 30 years. Dennis, welcome to the show.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for being here. It was fun to listen to Victoria.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I wanted to bring you on earlier, but it was Victoria's fault. I mean, she was just too interesting, and I couldn't interrupt her. So you can blame Victoria, okay?
Oh, I agree with you.
Okay. So listen, Dennis, slow medicine seems to lend itself perfectly to your population as a geriatrician. I would like to believe many geriatricians practice this way. No?
I think they do. I think there are a number of doctors all over the country and indeed all over the world who practice in this fashion. And some of the themes that Victoria raised are the same themes that they address. Relationship, medication use, finding a way to use time, not necessarily all in one block together, but to have things unfold over time. And to look at people's contexts and try to strengthen them. So it's not just that they are afflicted with problems, but they also have strengths which can be encouraged. And I see all of these themes arising in the chronic care population that Victoria cared for.
One of your concerns is that naturally occurring changes with the aging process are being defined as diseases and being treated. You use hypertension as an example, and it sounds a bit like what Victoria was talking about with that 78-year-old patient.
That's true. And Victoria, as I understand in conversations with her and reading her book, really cut her teeth on slow medicine with very, very complex chronically ill patients, many of whom were younger. Whereas what I see is everyone becomes more complicated as they get older. And so in a sense, all of us will fall into that category that Victoria has talked about. We will all need more in terms of supportive relationships. We will all need more time to really tease out the best decisions for us. We will need to recognize our interdependency with other people. For many of us, that means reestablishing relationships with family, with friends, finding ways to support ourselves as we get older. So the themes are similar.
What does it look like with a patient you're working with, this slow medicine? We've got one of our callers wanted to know, can slow medicine help someone with dementia or Alzheimer's?
Dementia is a great example where it can be helpful. And what we would do in our practice is with the earliest recognition of cognitive problems, begin to bring people who surround that patient and are supportive of them into discussions about how a life will unfold as dementia progresses and people are more in need of support. And this has to do with how we will approach medications, how we will pursue diagnoses, which may not mean as much. And Victoria had mentioned that, let's say, a small amount of diabetes or a tendency toward diabetes or a small degree of high blood pressure. All of those things in the context of somebody who is becoming demented become less important, because quality of life really resides in what happens to them day by day and hour by hour, and not in some kind of future where if you treat their blood pressure more aggressively, they will have a better future.
So the question I raised is interesting, because your response was a little bit different. So I talked about a caller who wanted to know, can you use slow medicine to treat dementia or Alzheimer's? And you talked about slow medicine as a way of managing it ethically and compassionately.
Right. Well, for people who have Alzheimer's or another kind of dementia, how you are with them at any moment in time, how much attention you give them, makes a huge difference. And what a good example is, there's language deterioration and the deterioration of understanding of language with dementia. But there oftentimes is the capacity to really sense all the nonverbal language that's happening in an encounter. So one of the primary things that's used in terms of being with someone who has dementia is to recognize that touch, facial expression, tone of voice, the way you move, all of that is an important aspect of making that moment better for them. So that's management in a way, but it also is treatment, because it steadies their life at that moment and for the minutes or hours or days to come.
You sound like you are practicing a meditative or mindfulness-based medicine, that you are bringing the moment right there into the office, and you're not dealing with future.
That's right. And being with somebody and being, you talked about having an open heart and a searching mind. When you're with any patient, I think the main role that we have, and I think Victoria exemplifies this in her practice, you try to be with and absorb as much understanding of that person as you can, not just from what they say or with what test results they may have, but actually to be with them to get a feel for who they are and what they're like as a person. That's why it's mindfulness.
You're both talking about something critically important here, the concept of being with. Mm-hmm. And you, Victoria, I want you to chime in here. You can't just do this because you decide to do it and you think it's a good idea. I mean, it does require some training, or maybe even some skills that you bring to training.
Yeah. And I think, and Victoria can comment on how she teaches this, but what I've done with medical students and residents in teaching them, or anyone who's involved in healthcare, is to explain that from the very first moment where, as a student, you are perceived as a part of the healthcare world, as a part of that healing world, every time and you have any kind of interchange with somebody or you're present with them, you can either have a positive effect on them or a negative effect. Seldom is it neutral. So you can be a healing presence, even as a very inexperienced medical student, by learning how to be present for people.
Victoria, tell us, how do you teach it?
Well, I'm glad Dennis came in there and sort of rescued me, so I had
to think
for a second. You know, I love what Dennis just said, and I think it's beautiful, and I think it's true. I also think that this quality we're talking about is a very natural quality. And in fact, we do it when we read. We do it all the time, actually. And I think of it not so much as learning something we don't do, as unlearning some things that we do do. So, I tell my students, you know, there's no such thing as multitasking. In fact, most people can't even unitask. We start with trying to, and unitasking is, I think, what we're talking about. It's being where you are, doing what you do, and we do it naturally, I think. It's just moving away what we're used to doing, our habitual grabbing and thinking and looking and that kind of stuff. So I guess that's what I would say. I mean, does it get better with practice? It does. And does it get better when the society supports it and gives you a space and a time to be that way? Absolutely.
I want to come all the way back to what we talked about in the beginning of the show about spiritus and ruach. And, you know, it's the breath. The breath is the currency of our soul, of our spirit. And I think to be present, the first thing you have to do is simply to be aware of your own breath, be aware of your breathing. And, you know, that slows things down. Mm-hmm. If you can be
It's a great technique, no question, and I do use it myself.
Yeah. Dennis, in your book, My Mother, Your Mother, you talk about practicing slow medicine at 8 stages of late life, going from stability to compromise through decline, death, and even grieving. So how does modern medicine treat these stations, and how does slow medicine do it?
Well, the idea of constructing a journey of late life was to help to give older people and family members and indeed health professionals a sense that there is a trajectory and there are identifiable places along that trajectory where many of us will find ourselves as life goes on. We're in crises, we're recovering, we're in a period of stability. And the point is that at each of those places along in our journey, there are very definite things that we can do to improve the sort of the quality of our life and the way in which we respond and interact to healthcare. For instance, in the first station, and the three of us are getting close to that, I would suspect, and that is we have to recognize that we are having to come together with people who know us, be they family or other people, because these are important. This is the important family of whatever kind of dimensions or whatever nature you want to give it that will guide us over time, because none of us can do this alone. And one of the wonderful things about movements like Aging in Place and Aging in Community is that this dimension is being recognized. And in fact, the dimension was very much there at Laguna Honda, as Victoria talks about.
Yeah.
You must be a bit of a film buff, Dennis. Your webpage has many suggested films on the topic of aging. Tell us one or two of your favorites and why.
Well, the film that triggered the whole journey of late life was a Japanese film, which talks about the carrying of an older person up the mountain when a family. It's both a physical journey, but also an emotional journey. And that would be sort of a historical film, and people can find it on my website. A more current one would be the film Quartet, which is now being shown all over, and really takes a look at relationships within a group of older people with lots of humor and a lot of a sense of what it means to be in one's 80s and above.
I've got to tell you, that film was a bit traumatic for me, because I discovered in reading about that film that Dustin Hoffman, who produced it, directed it, I think, is 75 years old.
Is he really?
Yeah, I was quite shaken by that, and I'm still not sleeping well, actually. Speaking of stages and stations, A dear friend of mine is studying to be a doula, an end-of-life doula, and I would imagine she would need the same skills as an end-of-life practitioner or a good psychotherapist, active listening, bearing witness without trying to be helpful.
Those are really the dimensions of it, and as I've grown older and being with more and more people who have been long time in my practice and really friends and who are dying, I find that what makes a difference is not necessarily the words, but the continuing commitment or covenant to showing up, to being with people, just being with people is really one of the important roles, because words alone can't accomplish the comfort, in a way.
I've been thinking this late in my career that words are just a poor vehicle to try to describe who we are. And, you know, it's all we got.
It's all we have, and it isn't. Because I think we really underestimate, for instance, sort of touch and contact.
Yeah.
And presence.
So you can literally feel the other person. Unfortunately, I'd love to talk with you guys for another couple of hours, but we are out of time. So I just want to thank you both so much for joining us, and thanks so much for the work you both do.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can hear Victoria Sweet at Villanova University. She's taking part in the Vivian Lamb Lecture Series on April 18th, and her book, God's Hotel, is out in paperback. Dennis McCullough will deliver the keynote address at Westchester University's Integrative Health Conference on April 20th, and his book is My Mother, Your Mother. Well, next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about what is our capacity for connection in the age of digital media. What does it give us, and what does it take away from us? Well, you can comment on today's show. We'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices, and you can listen to this and other shows there or on iTunes. And follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Mr. Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Hats off to Jennifer Lynn, our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.